content is one of the first things somebody will buy from you. They buy it from you with their time, and that's the most important asset.
Welcome to B2B Content Strategist, where we bring you insights and practical tips straight from the minds of top B2B content marketing experts. I'm Amy Woods, founder and CEO of Content 10X, and in each episode, I chat with leading B2B marketers about how they consistently craft and execute successful campaigns, even when faced with tight deadlines and limited resources. If you're looking to elevate and optimize your content marketing efforts, you're in the right place. Keep listening. Hello and welcome to B2B Content Strategies Podcast. I'm your host, Amy Woods, and today I'm joined by Jason Widdop, who is the Senior Vice President of Marketing at Pixis. Pixis is a well-funded AI startup in the ad tech space, leading global strategy across growth, product marketing, operations, and experiences. Jason has over two decades of experience driving growth for B2B technology companies like Tableau, Getty Images, AT&T, and Microsoft. He's built and scaled successful go-to-market programs through a combination of deep operational expertise and highly creative marketing strategies. I've been a fan of Jason since his days at Metadata, where we worked with Jason's marketing team to launch the Demand Gen U podcast, and we produced and repurposed all of the episodes of the show. Jason co-hosted it with the equally fantastic B2B marketing leader Mark Huber, and it was such a pleasure to work on. So I was really excited to interview Jason for this episode. We chat about why content is the first thing that buyers buy, how he built his marketing team from the ground up at Pixis. We discuss the story behind Jason's incentivized demo ad campaign that overwhelmed sales. We also talk about what Jason refuses to use AI for and why creativity still wins, and so much more. It really was a fantastic conversation. So without further ado, let's jump in. Jason, welcome to B2B Content Strategist. It's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to chat today.
Yeah, me too. I actually feel this is the first time we've properly spoken, but I feel like I've spoken to you before through seeing so many episodes of the Demand Gen U podcast when you were over at Metadata. So
that was so much fun. Yeah, Mark and Justin made that like super easy for me. It was just like, yeah, just show up and we'll have a nice conversation about something. And yeah, I was actually like pleasantly surprised. There's still people that actually, some founders that I even advise still today are going through the entire corpus. And they're just like, I'm watching every episode. I'm like, wow, it's still relevant today. It's great.
Yeah, it is. And it was fantastic. It blew up. I feel like it blew up anyway. It did really well, didn't it? And people saying that they still listen to it today. That's amazing. So yeah, there you go. The power of podcast, hey?
Exactly.
Hence, here we are today. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. To get started, would you mind just sharing a little bit about your role and also what Pixis does as well?
Yeah, I'll start with Pixis. I'll be really brief. We're an ad tech platform for consumer advertisers that uses AI to basically optimize every phase of the advertising lifecycle, from ideation all the way through, you know, creative and optimization. I work with some amazing brands as well that I'm still surprised by today, like, you know, Coach and Crocs and Pepsi, and there's brands I never thought I'd work with when I was really in the B2B2B ecosystem. And my role is SVP of marketing there, which basically oversees all aspects of marketing. I also, the BDR team reports to me at Pixis as well, which I know everybody has their own school of thought about that. You know, does it belong in sales? Does it belong in marketing? And the unique thing about this role is I've been in it for about 7 months, but, you know, we didn't have a marketing team before I joined. And so even though we'd gotten to about 70 million in ARR, we did that all through, you know, founder relationships, outbound sales, referrals, you know, like word of mouth. And so for me, it was a really unique opportunity to come in, build a team from scratch. So get to hire everybody, which I love. You know, usually you enter a company like this and you're inheriting an entire team, and it's just a lot of them sometimes don't meet your expectations and you didn't put them together, you know, so you don't have that strong relationship. So getting to hire a team of people that I look up to that I've always wanted to work with has been nice. And yeah, and just really starting the function kind of from scratch, you know, no content program, no advertising, nothing, no, like really nothing going on other than events, I would say. Events was basically marketing for us. And yeah, so here we are 7 months later, built a, you know, still a small but mighty team. And yeah, I'm just starting to like really get that marketing motion going for us. So that becomes hopefully a competitive advantage for us.
Mm. So, I mean, obviously they were doing so well up to the point of then deciding, right, we need to develop a marketing function now and get a marketing leader in. What was the catalyst or the turning point, so to speak, do you think that decision was made that now we need to go more just from the sales to the marketing?
Yeah, I mean, I think first you just start to realize I'm exhausting all of these relationships. You know, your investors are like, I've introduced you to everybody, you know, and you're like, I've gone through my Rolodex. And so there's part of that fatigue, right? We're just kind of like, okay, we can kind of tell it's starting to slow down and we can't fill it all up with just outbound sales. And then our investors actually were probably the biggest folks requesting it. You know, hey, you guys need marketing. You need marketing. So just like kind of hammering the founders of like, it's time, you know, you guys, let's actually do some marketing here. And I just think it's doubly important when you're marketing to marketers to have good marketing. It's a lot of marketing, but because they see it every day, they know what they're going to have an opinion on what good looks like. You don't want to try and sell a marketing platform, if you, in my opinion, if you can't do good marketing yourself, because it's just a psychological leap of like, all right, you want me to do business with your platform, but I can't see myself in you because you're not really doing great marketing. So you must not have a great platform. And they'll make that mental leap. And so when I came in, before I even accepted the job, I said, this is a big effort. It's not just like taking a random like fintech thing, selling to finance people, and then starting to market. It's like we're marketing to marketers. So we have to like wow them. We've got to exceed their expectations. We want them to look up to us in our marketing and want to be like that. And so I really started with the brand, and I did a complete brand refresh, like completely. Everything's new. Colors, logos, fonts, everything, tone. And we launched that in April. And have just really been trying to expand, bring more human elements into the brand, being, you know, giving it a personality and starting to build that asset.
And you said that you have a small but mighty team at the moment. So what does that look like? And what were the key priority roles that you first thought we need to fill here?
Yeah. Out of all the marketing disciplines, I would say I have the most experience in demand gen and growth. I started my career in ops and analytics, and so I've always had this kind of data lens on things. And then I also know at the same time that the reason marketing exists is to help sell more product. And so demand gen and growth is one of the most important functions. So that was my first hire. I wanted to find, I was calling it a demand gen scientist in my mind. I really wanted somebody that was AI native already, you know, I didn't have to learn AI and how to use AI in their role, knew all the tools, was really ops, like operations focused. And I found that, well, I didn't even have to find them. I knew them. And so that was my first role that I hired for, is head of growth. Then from there, I also knew that content was going to be one of the most important functions for us, content and product marketing. And content, because I've used content as a growth lever in the past, not just for growth, but also for brand. And I just know how well it can work. And I've always said content is one of the first things somebody will buy from you. And they're buying it with your time. And I think I felt this way, but actually my head of content solidified just in this way, like buy from you. It was that buy from you that I was like, I didn't have that as part of my lexicon, but he's like, they buy it from you with their time. And that's the most important asset. And so I like to use content for a couple of things: to show our expertise and intelligence, to show our personality, to drive and build trust. And so, and the thinking is, and getting adding value. So not talking about our products almost at all, but adding value. And so, so it earns a right to show them our product. So content was important. So hired a head of content, another person that I've known for a long time, I've tried to work with in the past and didn't get to. So now two people that I've wanted to work with for a long time. Product marketing, we had a head of product marketing in place, but unfortunately that person was well over their head. And so I had to make the difficult decision to replace that person and found a head of product marketing that is just outstanding. Didn't know her though. So, but she has experience with some of our competitors. So just came, hit the ground running. And then a head of events, because events have been working for us. And I had somebody running events that just didn't have event experience. So I hired a head of events. Oh, I was like, where's the last one? So Pixis as a company, we actually have acquired 11 performance marketing agencies. So we actually own, we have over 200 people in an agency, basically. We have like over a 200 person agency now, essentially, with that. And we are basically putting them all under this umbrella called Stellar. And so Stellar is our agency, like holding company, if you will. And so I hired a head of Stellar marketing. So a head of marketing for that Stellar brand, who's basically tapping into the rest of my team for some of the stuff, but also working with the agencies themselves to do a lot of the marketing, just to build a brand around that. Because right now there's no brand for Stellar, it's still just the individual agencies. So that was a primarily like the first level hires. And then I've got some other team members in there that report into those, but that's the kind of leadership that I hired.
Yeah, it's a wonderful situation to be in, like you said, where you can start at the start, and instead of inheriting a team with, you know, sometimes the good sides of that, and obviously sometimes you don't really want the team that you've inherited, and not everybody, to be able to assemble the people that you want to work with. I heard a great saying, I was at a round table the other week and they were talking about building a team, and somebody said, you know, I prefer to say you assemble a team, and it made me think like Avengers assemble, like marketers assemble, like you assemble them together. So I really like that. And then question maybe for your current role, but maybe just across other roles that you've had in your career too. What do you prefer to typically keep in-house versus the skill set or just the, you know, the function that you prefer to work with outsourced suppliers, agencies, or especially freelancers, that kind of thing?
Yeah, this one shifts for me. Early on, you don't often have a choice, right? So like really early on, you have to work with freelancers because you don't have enough budget or resource to hire a full-time person. So there's just sometimes when you're starting out, or depending on the size of the company and what you're trying to do, where it's just, that's the only way you can do it. But even in that, I prefer to try and find freelancers. There's a lot more freelancers today than there ever have been. And so I think oftentimes you can find the right, especially if you just like, no, hey, this is a role I need to fill, but I'm not quite there yet. Let me find a fractional, or let me find a, you know, like an individual person. Where I look for agencies, that's usually in creative and sometimes content. Content though is another one where it's like, okay, you could find freelancers, but I've had a harder time finding content freelancers than others, because I just think it's maybe easier for anybody to say they're a content freelancer. And so I just know in my experience trying to find one, I just go to the people that I know, you know, that I've worked with in the past, because it's too hard. I've tried, and every single day I probably get 5 LinkedIn messages from content freelancers, you know, and I know why that is. It's like, part of it is because a lot of them have been laid off and this is the route to a livelihood because they can't find another full-time job. That's not the best ones to find, you know, and then there's the ones that are like dedicated, like I'm all in on this because I've made a successful career in content and now I'm doing it on my own. So that's why I prefer agencies there, because then they're doing the work of like vetting it. And that's a hard one to vet. And then especially for like high value content, because now we're using AI to write a lot of the content with humans in the loop, but there's still something to, the best content is going to be like through primary research and your own data and that kind of thing. And sure, you can give that to AI. And then when you want to like interview people and include some of that stuff and just have a more of a human lens on it, I find that working with an agency can help. But yeah. And then creative, I just think to build an in-house creative team to do the kind of creative that I want to do would be really expensive. And so I just think that creative is an easy one to just continually do to agents, you know, outsourced agencies. You could build an in-house production creative team. The hardest part though, I think, is like that creative director and just like finding somebody that's just gonna help build that brand. I'm horrible at creative. So I like draw stick figures and, you know, like I'm trying to like get my concept across, can take my horrible chicken scratch and like bad attempt at trying to draw something and turn it into something great, or just hear what I have to say and like turn it into something, that's hard to find. And I find that it's easier to find, you know, to again, look at agencies, look at their prior work, talk to them, figure out, all right, we've got a good synergy here. I think you can represent my brand. So yeah, those two. Most other things in-house, especially like some of the ones I think are important to keep in-house are like operations and analytics, first of all, because there's so much nuance and so much like how I set this up and it's not documented and all these like hidden skeletons, you know, of like in operations and how things are cobbled together that I found sometimes when you lose an ops person that's been there for a long time, it is a disaster. You know, it can like really wreak havoc. Things break. Nobody knows how to fix it anymore. What happened to our YouTube login? Well, it went with Jimmy, you know, out the door when they left. It's just the ops role, the analytics roles, us, and with analytics too, just constantly looking at your own data and having that the human brain and pattern recognition come into play by just looking at that data all the time, so often, so frequently. Those are just ones I think you really can't replace. And then leading any function, you know, like you don't necessarily want to bring in a freelancer or agency to lead a function. That's just also doesn't work.
No, I agree. Just a super quick break from this conversation to let you know that if you're a B2B technology or professional services company and you want help with streamlining your content operations, outsourcing your content repurposing is the number one way to produce more high quality content and boost your ROI without putting any more pressure on your team. In fact, it could save your team up to 30 hours per week. We offer content repurposing services for video and audio content. Whether you have a show or you're launching a brand new one, maybe you have an archive of awesome content, be it webinars or a virtual event, or you want help creating thought leadership content that we can repurpose, we've got you covered. Head to content10x.com to see how we can help you and start increasing your efficiency and the value you get from your content. Now, back to the conversation. I love this next question. Maybe in from the current role, although I know you said it's only 7 months or so otherwise, just across your career, what would you say is one of the most memorable marketing campaigns that you've been involved in, and not necessarily most successful, but like just the most memorable, and why?
Yeah. Honestly, and this will probably be it for my career at this point, but some people know, but a lot of people might not know, I was basically the father of incentivized conversation ads, like for demos. And I started it in the beginning of the pandemic in 2020 and basically grew metadata off the backs of incentivized conversation ads. So if you don't know what that is, LinkedIn conversation ad, it appears in your messages inbox. It has a statement and then it has buttons that you can answer. And then based on how you answer, it branches and it can answer that, you know, and kind of keep you going down. So you're basically introducing them to your product and company, saying why they should care, giving them the offer. Hey, would you come onto a friendly demo with us for an exchange for $100? I want to respect your time. You know what I mean? I know your time is valuable and I want to treat it that way. And then it qualifies them like, great, they're interested. Okay, cool. And then qualifies them just to make sure they're not coming in for the $100, you know, hey, just want to make sure you're not a douchebag, you know, and like, and you're going to come into your good faith. You make decisions in this space. And those ads, especially if you're an up and coming company that has really good technology, but low awareness, it can really help you break through. Cause what you're trying to do is you just want to, and if you got to be really good at targeting and knowing your ICP because you want to be very targeted with this offer. But what it does is when you have a really good product, the most important thing is to get it in front of people. And most people, especially if you're marketing to marketers, they come to your website and they just don't believe anything on there because they are our marketer. And they're like, yeah, you found a way to say this. It's nuanced. This isn't right. There's some hidden stuff behind this. So the goal is to get it in front of people so they can see it. And this allows that. The conversion rates are lower than like a inbound organic demo request. Of course, there's an incentive involved. There might not be immediate pain, but they are the right person. They're the right company. So I spent hundreds of thousands, if not over $1 million, probably by now, on these types of ads for several companies. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. Certain audiences I found like, okay, they're not quite on this. Non-marketing audiences, often like will, maybe it doesn't work so much for, but I was one of the first, if not the first to do this, especially I was definitely the first to do this in conversation ads. Definitely was not the first to do an incentivized demo campaign, but through that channel. So yeah, most memorable because we ran it for years. It would fatigue, but not much. It just kept, it was like the gift that kept on giving. In fact, at one point I had my head of sales ask me twice, please slow down the volume of demos. Like,
you can't
and that
cope.
Is the shining moment of my career. Having a head of sales actually asked me to slow down demo requests. I'll never forget that. So yeah, so that's probably my most and yeah, not super sexy, but it was at the time a little groundbreaking. Part of the repercussion is actually people thought we did those ads because they were so unique at that time. They were like, oh, you must do these ads. And we're like, oh. So we actually built that into our product to actually be able to support that ad type because people were just wanting to run that same play. And so we actually built it into the platform.
That's so interesting. I wasn't really familiar with that process, you know, the incentivized ads and things like that. That was really interesting. I imagine you played around with all sorts of incentives to find the sweet spot then. Did you keep just kind of tweaking it with what do people want? Okay.
In the beginning of the pandemic, it was perfect because it was a DoorDash gift card. And if you remember beginning of pandemic, everybody was like, I'm tired of cooking, you know? And so it was perfect. You know, it was like a perfect offer. Then when that started to fizzle, we just started to introduce like Amazon, you know, and that became the next best thing. And I've played around with other things. I've played around with a charity gift, like you give the money away. Guess what? Marketers are fickle. They're like, no, I want my money. You know, that fell flat. I've actually recently started upping the offer, thinking that would actually work. It's actually backfired a little bit. And what's interesting is there's a sweet spot in the offer where if it's too much, you will absolutely get the wrong people in for the wrong reasons. So I was actually running a campaign around Aura rings, right? This Aura ring, which I like live my life by. It's a $400, $500 ring. But my clever approach was, I know the Pixis platform is going to reduce your stress and give you back more sleep, that I want to prove it to you, you know, and I'll send you an Aura ring to prove how much less, you know, like how much more sleep you're getting, how much less stress you're experiencing because you're using our platform. I thought it was super clever, but I think there's skepticism first when it gets to be too high. Like, huh, why are they, that's a $400, $500 thing and just for 30 minutes of my time. And then there's the, no, I'm the right person, but I don't care about your platform at all. Just give me this damn ring. I'm going to get on the phone. So there is a balance somewhere. It's above $100 for sure. But it's below 400. It's somewhere in there. Probably 200, 250 is my guess.
I'm sure there's so many stories to tell with those calls as well. But yeah, that's super interesting. In terms of content now, so the types of content that you create, it wouldn't be a podcast with me without me mentioning something about repurposing. So of all the different long form content that we have, I know you've been in loads of podcasts and things like that. You guys have got a podcast, white papers, reports, etc., blog posts, videos. What kind of content is your go-to favorite for knowing that you are going to get the maximum return from spinning it off into other types of content as well?
Yeah, it's this. It's a video interview.
Video type, podcast.
Style format. Yeah. It can be presented as a podcast. It can be presented as just, lately I've just been like, let's just get on a call and record ourselves having a conversation. You know, it's not a podcast. I don't have the, you know, this isn't under a name of a podcast. But I'm going to take that and I'm going to transcribe it and have AI help me write a blog post about it. I'm going to run it through probably like Opus or some AI clipping tool and get 75, social clips from it. I'm going to take little quotes and I'm probably going to use that with a static image for maybe a social post or even an ad. Yeah, there's just like lots. I'm going to create a LinkedIn post about it, and direct people to it. I'm going to load the video somewhere. I might load, if maybe it is a podcast, I'm going to load it on audio, in podcast somewhere. So yeah, it's really starting with video because then that's like, you can't start with text and turn it into video, right? So it's like start at the very top and then you can cascade it down through the less rich media formats, I guess. So yeah, as much as possible, starting on video. There's video fatigue too, right? People are getting a little bit fatigued on video, not necessarily watching it, but doing it. So I'm also trying to come up with some new ideas around that, like more in-person ideas. And I'm still trying. My fantasy is to take people on hikes, because I like to hike. I hike, you know, I climb mountains, I hike a lot. Take people on a hike and have us mic'd up, you know, during the hike, and we just have a conversation on the hike with cameras somehow. Like, I don't know, like somebody, you know, I don't know if I've got to hire a drone operator or, like, I don't know, somebody to come along and just walk with us and film, or we put rigs on ourselves, you know what I mean, or the camera pointed back at us. I don't know exactly how, but that's my dream, is to be able to do something outside like that and in person, because I think now we're also, from a viewing perspective, we're also kind of getting tired of, like, just seeing, you know, my background here in my house. And so I actually did one last year where I took the person who helped train me to climb Mount Rainier, I took her up like 3,000 feet, and I just set up my iPhone. We both had Rode mics on. I brought my little camping chairs I can throw in my backpack, set them up. Had this amazing mountainous backdrop. These microphones work way better than I ever thought they could. You could hear nothing other than our voices. Mosquitoes, in fact, one point we had to just, like, pause for a mosquito, like, repellent break, you know, and we just kept that in because it was
content.
Funny.
And, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I'm trying to figure out how to make that happen. Yeah. So video.
I love that. Yeah,
a long
yeah.
way around saying video. One word answer.
I completely agree with everything that you said. That's always my answer as well. Like you said, it's got the most dimensions sitting at the top. But I love what you said. I do think the variety, and moving on to AI, I guess, as well, just what you were saying about getting out there, people, human interest, things like that, with all the AI generated content and things like that, that kind of content that is just so human, isn't it? Two people on a hike, having a conversation, top of a mountain, ChatGPT and Perplexity having a chat on the top of a mountain. Like, this is the where we need to lean into real voices, people, experiences. You already mentioned AI tools. You were talking about what you do with video and putting it Opus, etc. So we've mentioned AI. You also said a key hire that you wanted to hire needed to be an AI native. So it's key that you guys are using AI. What in particular do you stay clear of? So instead of just asking the question, what are you using it for? What do you have a pretty hard stance on? Like, you know, what do we not use AI for in the marketing specific function?
Yeah, right now, very clear. It's image generation, really. And well, just span it to video generation, although I haven't played with it that much. It's just, I feel like the amount of, now I know the corollary, which is like, go shoot your own image, is also way hard. But trying to get an image that I am like, I love this, I want to use this, at least in my limited experience, I've not dove in and given it like the full college try, I will say that. But when I've tried to work with it, for example, this isn't even in advertising, but I have a new house, I have a backyard that's got like the most basic landscaping. And I was like, oh, I should be able to use AI to help me like build a plan for the landscaping in my backyard. I tell you what, after hours, days, my wife's trying it. It's just like, it just doesn't look right. You know, it doesn't look real. I can't get it right. So I was like, just hand draw it was better, you know, just, and I don't draw like we talked about earlier. I'm stick figuring it. So that's an area where I just don't think it's ready. Or it's ready, but you still have to put in a lot of time and effort to get to the image and kind of the stuff that you want. Video, I think, is coming around pretty interestingly. I still feel like I can tell when it's an AI video, but I think we're getting pretty close to like not being able to tell. Some of the like fake UGC video content that I've seen, I'm like, if I just saw this in a feed quickly, I might not be able to tell this is AI, which I hate. I hate that. I don't want to live in that world, but it's the world we're going to. So yeah, those areas I'd say. Everything else though is kind of open game. And honestly, if somebody wanted to put the time in to try and get to images, great. I'm not going to stop you. You know, I don't have like a hard rule, but I also don't expect AI to come up with anything groundbreaking from a creative standpoint, because it's referencing everything that's been done in the past, not, you know, I always use this like example in the 60s when people were doing a lot of drugs, right? Like hallucinogens and like, you know, mind expanding, mind altering kind of drugs. You actually saw a huge change in creative taste, in like just things that would come, you know, just things that we considered creative or tasteful or interesting on the creative stamp, you know, and it took that unlock, you know what I mean, for a lot of people. And I'm not saying everybody go like, you know, go smoke toad frog poison or anything like that, but it's the human brain getting connected in different ways that's going to come up with something brand new and innovative from a creative standpoint, not a machine. Again, my opinion, machine is good at taking what you've come up with and now giving you 100 iterations on it, but I don't think it's not going to be the thing coming up with like, wow, I've never seen that before and that's super cool and interesting and now everyone starts using it.
Yeah. It's not going to be us with the creativity, is it? I completely agree. So I'm going to ask you the question that we got posed from our last guest on the show. So I always like this. We don't know whether the fit for the question is going to be right for each guest because I don't say who the next guest is. So it can go either way. But, you know, it's always a good conversation starter anyway. So the person who is asking you this question is Jess Larkin, and she is a director in financial services marketing at Confluent. So her question is,
data is driving so much of what we do in marketing today when it comes to strategy, planning, when you're looking at success of a program. However, I firmly believe that anecdotal details help to move the needle. When you are thinking about your marketing strategy and planning, outside of the data inputs, what other cross-functional stakeholders help inform your plan?
This is a great question, because I've gone through cycles myself in my career around this, where because I started in ops and analytics, there was a large part of my career where I would literally say just marketing is a math job. If we can just figure out the math, we win at marketing. So I would rely pretty exclusively on data and what it would tell me. And then as I just got more experienced, I started realizing like attribution was big for a long time. Oh, let's, you know, attribution models, let's do the Markov chain modeling and all the sophisticated attribution. And you get that done and you put all this time and effort into it. And you realize this is no better than just like looking at first touch and last touch attribution. You know, you're like, I'm not getting any more insights. And I just spent half a year and $250,000 building this attribution platform, which is a true story, which I did do that at Tableau and didn't have anything to really speak for it, you know, hired college professors, you know, in like Markov chain modeling. And just I was hell bent on we're going to solve this problem. And we didn't. And I think just as I got more experience in my career, more things under my belt, I just started realizing gut and intuition is just as important as data in these things. And there's nothing that can replace the amount of experience that I have and all the things I've seen and all the things I've seen work and not work and how I put all those together in my brain and how my intuition helps me look at something and make a decision or look at something and know that's going to work or that's not going to work. Or be confident enough to say, I can't measure this at all, but I'm going to still do it because I believe in it. So yeah, I think it's really important. And this is actually a conversation I had with my CFO when I joined here, because I was like, I'm not joining unless this conversation I have with my CFO goes well. And it was, 50% of the things I do, I'm not going to be able to tell you how they performed, because it's going to be a brand. It's going to be some kind of activation that we have no tracking on. But if we don't do those things, we will absolutely fail. And so I need to understand I need to tell you my perspective and make sure you understand that the total spend that I'm going to do and the total demand I'm going to drive, that'll be positive. But at an individual line item level, not. And I firmly believe in that. If you only do the things that are measurable, if you only do the things where you have data, you won't do good marketing because you're going to do the same things that everybody else is doing or the same basic things that can be measured easily. And you're just going to ignore the things that, you know, like, for example, like if you do a big stunt, like offer a $10,000 prize, you know, for some kind of like thing, there's, of course, people are going to click on it and participate, but there's so much more brand goodwill that you get from people talking about it or just seeing it. And they're like, $10,000 prize. Whoa. They make these psychological connections and things. And so, yeah, I think it's, stepping out of the data, trusting your gut and intuition.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that only gets better the more experience that you have. But I still think even in the early stages of somebody's career, your gut will be telling you something. And to just because something can be measured and just because there is data doesn't mean it's more important than something else that is less measurable. But you get more confident, I guess, more gutsy, don't you, the more experience you have to have that conversation with your CFO. So obviously a good conversation to have. And he took the job, so I'm sure he said the answer that you wanted him to say, or she, him or he or she. The final question is turned to you. So same thing, we, you know, all the guests on the podcast are leaders within a B2B marketing function. And what would you like to ask?
Yeah. There's a lot of questions, but I think one interesting one that I've been noodling on lately is I fundamentally believe search is going to change, right? Like search as we know it is going away and everything is going to be now with AI and LLMs, right? And it's already happening. So if we agree that that's a given, what strategies or how are people, how is it, you know, how are you, this marketing leader, thinking about organic traffic in the context of AI LLMs versus SEO? I'll just leave it open-ended like that. Nothing more specific than that, but how are you thinking about it? And are you doing anything to like address it or learn more about it?
Yeah, I love that question. That's something that is heavy on my mind and something that we talk about a lot at Content 10X as well, but everything's changing. Look at our own behaviors. I never Google anything anymore. I just tend to go to ChatGPT or Perplexity, whichever one I think is going to be best for what I want to know. We're all changing behaviors. Yeah. So it's hugely impactful on SEO and all of that massively. So that's a fantastic question. Thank you. Well, you know, there's loads more I would have asked you and wanted to ask, but we have run out of time. So like I'm
respectful. Long in the tooth. So yeah, you had a fun conversation with Jason, but you only get 3 questions. Yeah.
No, it was absolutely great. Thank you so much for your time. Time is so precious, as we said, when we were talking about marketing first comes from people's time, doesn't it? So I really do appreciate sharing so much value. Is there any next step that you'd like any of the listeners to take after hearing this conversation?
I guess, you know, just a really broad one is marketing should be fun. And I think that, especially in startups, marketers just get, I don't want to say shit on, but like, you know, marketing is a hard job. And so many demands, and there's this like notion of like attribution and how, what do we get credit for? And some founders just do marketing. They treat marketing like a dentist, you know, it's like nobody wants to do it, but everybody has to. And it's just not, you know, and so there's a lot of things that like a lot of downward pressure on marketers. And I just know myself, if I'm not in a good headspace, I'm not doing my best work. And so find ways to have fun with the job, find sources of levity. And just make sure that it's not your life. Like your job, marketing, that's not your life. Your life is your hobbies, the things you do outside, how you treat people. And just like keep that in perspective.
Absolutely fantastic. And I think you become a better marketer if you have all of those extra hobbies and things like that, because half the time I crack the code to something I've been trying to work on all day when I'm playing tennis or climbing a mountain or that kind of thing. So it makes us better, doesn't it? Thank you so much. Brilliant last word. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate time. Thank you for everyone that is listening to this episode as well. And we'll catch you in the next episode.
Appreciate it. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of B2B Content Strategist. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. Feel free to connect with me on social media. You can find me, Amy Woods, founder of Content 10X, on LinkedIn. If you get in touch, please do leave a message and let me know that you listen to B2B Content Strategist. You can also connect with Content 10X. We're on LinkedIn, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And for more insights on optimizing your content marketing and the power of repurposing, head over to content10x.com. You'll discover valuable resources to help you maximize the impact of your content. We have our sister podcast, the Content 10X Podcast, hundreds and hundreds of blog posts, and a library full of free resources and guides all about how to be a better content creator and content repurposer. If you're seeking consulting support or a trusted partner to handle your content creation, repurposing, and distribution, then also reach out to us. We offer a world-class, fully managed service that takes care of as much or as little as you need when you need it. Once again, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I'll catch you in the next one.